This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National, and so to the first of our special series on the future of zoos. Lynn Malcolm.
Here we are in the orangutan kitchen.
Yeah, there are crates here of spinach and celery, and I can see a pineapple top there, I think.
Yep. The orangutans really like the tropical fruits. So when we take a behind-the-scenes tour, the group will come in here and they'll help us prepare some treats for the animals, and then we go and meet one of them out the back. So we can go and meet the young male cluet, if you like.
Great. Let's go. Emma Yenge, Assistant Curator of Mammals at Adelaide Zoo in South Australia. She's about to connect me with this intriguing endangered ape of the Southeast Asian forest, the orangutan. Hello, I'm Lynn Malcolm. In this two-part science show series, we'll be looking at the changing role of zoos and their potential in the future.
Cluet! Cluet! Hello!
Hello there.
Here he is, the gorgeous little boy.
And how about a treat? Yes, just gently putting his lips up. Can I touch his hand?
Yeah, if he allows you.
Hello. He won't quite look at me, but he's still happy for me to be. I'm just patting his fingers. They're hairy. They're a little bit leathery, but they actually feel fairly human, really. They feel like human skin. And he's quite happy. Oh, no, just push me away a little bit. And here's a Brazil nut. I love the way that lip, that bottom lip goes out really delicately. Just say, put it in here, please.
Yeah, little catchment area, isn't it? Oh, don't want that.
Not that.
Pushed it back.
No, pushed it out.
It's the grapes you want, isn't it?
Mm. That was amazing.
Well, he's ended the contact. He's gone. That's how we usually end.
That was very special.
And these are the special experiences that people have that we can offer people so that they can really connect with the individuals and therefore the whole species.
Mm. Worldwide, zoos attract a vast audience of around 600 million visitors a year. That's greater than the number who go to watch sports events. Traditionally, a visit to the zoo is a great family day out, and the kids just may learn something about lions or giraffes along the way. But with more than a third of all animal species having become extinct in the last 30 years, there's enormous potential for zoos to play a greater role in saving wildlife and their habitats. That's by what they can do within their walls and outside in nature. So will zoos remain largely as menageries for entertainment, or can they become true agents for conservation? David Hancox has worked in and written about zoos for many years.
Some zoos are making some good progress, although the record so far is really not very good. They're fewer in number than one could wish for, but the ones that are doing something need to be applauded, and hopefully there will be more beginning to copy them.
I finished my basic degree at Adelaide Uni, and then I went on a trip around Europe, and I was actually quite depressed by what I saw in zoos. And at that time I thought, well, I don't think I can ever go to a zoo again. And then I thought, but if all scientists think that, then zoos will never improve.
Psychologist Carla Litchfield from the University of South Australia.
So that was a real turning point. And I then went and did my PhD primarily with chimps to improve the environment and their welfare. And then I went on to Africa and have spent a lot of time in Uganda with chimps and gorillas. And now I'm trying to help Zoos SA build up the area of conservation psychology, which is now a passion of mine.
Conservation psychology, a new discipline using psychological insights in the cause of protecting wildlife. Carla Litchfield was brought into Zoos South Australia by its director Chris West in his endeavour to turn Adelaide Zoo and its sister Open Range Zoo at Monarto into conservation organisations in the broadest sense. He explains his mission for the zoos.
It's quite simple. We exist to save species from extinction. That's our mission, our motto, our guiding principle. I see our role into the future as really being twofold. One is that we are the refugee centre for endangered species, with that last bastion where we can breed and secure a future for as many as we can hold, which isn't anything like enough in today's world. And the other thing that we are is a recruitment centre, if you like. So what we want to do is inform and inspire people through education and interpretation so that they go away from a zoo visit feeling thoughtful and transformed and hopeful.
And not only hopeful about exotic animals, but also those closer to home. Many zoos have been criticised for focusing too much on foreign species.
I think that zoos should concentrate much more on their local species, and I think conservation is at the heart of the reason for that, because people are going to be much more effective in saving wild species that are within their own national and legal and political areas of concern and activity. And that's why I think zoos can do an enormous amount to encourage people to be aware of how important it is to save the wildlife in their own backyards. And if more zoos did that, there would be many benefits, I think, particularly since you cannot seriously talk about conservation of animals without talking about conservation of habitat. And that's what I think zoos could be much more effective in doing, is to encourage their visitors to get involved and supportive in programs about saving habitats in their own regions. But zoos in general focus almost entirely on exotics. Australian zoos are unusual in that they do have usually more native species in their collections than zoos in other nations.
When Chris West came from London Zoo to take over Zoos South Australia about 3 years ago, he was shocked at the state of Australia's native mammals in the wild.
I had no idea that it was as bad as it was. Australia's lost 37 mammal species in the last couple of hundred years. It's the worst record of any country. And people should know that this is happening. So, no, I think it's crucially important. The heart of what we do is our conservation program, and we have bred and reintroduced bilbies and various rock wallabies, and we're looking after a whole list of native species, including Tassie devils, because if we can't save them on our doorstep, what can we save?
My name's Mick Post, and I'm a senior keeper of native fauna at Monado Zoo, and I'm just about to grab a Tasmanian devil out of his den.
Seems to have settled down now. Can we talk?
We can indeed. This is Australia's largest carnivorous marsupial, the Tasmanian devil. And this handsome young boy here is called Dexter.
Dexter.
And yeah, he's one of our prime breeding males for this up-and-coming season. They're a marsupial, so they actually have a pouch, the females do. They give birth to tiny little babies, then they climb to the pouch and they grow up in the pouch, so...
It's an amazing-looking creature. It looks to me a little bit like a little muscly dog, but it's also a bit cat-like.
Yeah, absolutely. They're completely black, usually, with a few white markings. Tasmanian devils became extinct on mainland Australia about 500 years ago, they think. But yeah, there's still a stronghold of them in Tasmania. But there is an issue today with a disease in Tasmania called devil facial tumour disease. This disease is a cancer. It's a contagious cancer, so it's spread from cell-to-cell contact. So these tumours just grow so big to a point that the animal can't hunt and feed properly, so it actually starves to death. So it's a really cruel, horrible death. And yeah, at the moment, I think it's about 70% of devils have been lost from the wild population already. It's probably going to be as high as 80, 90% of animals gone.
So what's the zoo doing for Tasmanian devils?
We're actually part of what we call the insurance population. So when they first saw the tumour disease and they weren't sure of what exactly was causing it and how it was passed on, they decided to establish an insurance colony of devils on the mainland of Australia. So there's five main zoos on the mainland Australia which are breeding facilities, and we're one of those. So when I say insurance, it means if devils do go extinct in Tasmania, this population is there ready for reintroduction.
A lot of our marsupials, the numbers are very, very low, and so we might talk about 1,500 or 3,000 giant pandas in the wild, but over here in Australia, for some of our species, we're talking tens, not thousands, tens. So they're right on the brink of extinction.
David Taggart is a researcher employed by both Adelaide Zoo and the University of Adelaide.
So this is the weight animal facility here.
With some extraordinary science, he's rising to the challenge of preventing the disappearance of native creatures, such as rare wallabies. David's developed a technique for boosting their numbers by manipulating the special way marsupials rear their young. He takes the young from pouches of endangered species and places them in surrogate mothers of common ones. We hope to catch a glimpse of one of the wallabies raised this way.
There he is. Oh, there he goes.
Oh, he just went running past us. Let's describe it.
That was a brush-tailed rock wallaby. They're about 2 feet high, and they've got a rufousy coloured fur across their rump and a distinctive white cheek stripe and black ears and a black face. But now they're one of the country's most threatened species in Victoria. I think there's only 25 left in Victoria before they're extinct. If you come down around here, we'll see the group of surrogate animals we use. They're yellow-footed rock wallabies.
Oh, there they go. They're all leaping about.
So these animals you can see here, they're yellow-footed rock wallabies. They've got a beautiful, distinctive coat with yellow tail and yellow forearms and a white cheek stripe and white stripes on their flanks.
Oh, look at them. They're, the four of them sitting up there just looking at us in the sunlight.
Yeah. These animals are one of the surrogate species we use for our endangered brush-tailed rock wallabies. The yellowfoots occur in the arid zone in South Australia, whereas the brush-tailed rock wallabies are temperate zone species and they occur in the mountainous areas up the east coast of Australia.
So would these animals actually have pouch young of brush-tailed rock wallabies in their pouches right now?
Yeah, we've got three of these females you can see here in front of us carrying endangered brush-tailed rock wallaby pouch young of different ages.
The cross-species fostering doesn't deny the endangered mother of raising young, because marsupials are unusual in that they always have a spare embryo in waiting in their wombs. So when David Taggart takes a youngster from a mother's pouch, another soon takes its place. This is a way of accelerating the reproduction rate of the endangered species. The scientists don't only use this method with animals in captivity.
We've also used that technique to recruit pouch young from wild-based animals, so we can go out along the Snow River Gorge in eastern Victoria and trap a female with a tiny pouch young and harvest that young, put it in an incubator, hike it out of the gorge, jump in a light plane, fly from East Gippsland all the way across to Adelaide, a distance of about 1,000 kilometres, and bring it across to where we've got a captive population of a suitable surrogate species and transfer it into the pouch of that surrogate mother. What that does, one, it gives us an opportunity to harvest the genetics from a wild-based endangered female, but it also has the added advantage that by removing that little pouch young from that female in the wild, we know that we haven't robbed her of her recruitment for that whole year, because in 30 days' time, she'll give birth to another pouch young, and so that young will be replaced.
And the zoo scientists are now successfully reintroducing captive reared wallabies, along with other species, back into their wild habitats. Elsewhere in the wilds, Adelaide Zoo is studying pelicans on a small island on the outskirts of the city. It's a breeding colony for pelicans and other seabirds. Greg Johnston, a scientist for the zoo and Flinders University, guides me through the frenzy.
Just come up the hill here, and oh my goodness, it's just a sight to behold. There are pelicans and gulls and ibis just
everywhere.
So some person has nicely estimated that there are 15,000 silver gulls here. We reckon there are about 4,000 white ibis, and currently there are just under 600 pelican nests here, so double that number of adults.
Oh,
Oh, he's a
happy live
baby
one.
Pelican. Wow.
So this guy's about a month old.
Yeah. And they're just really very awkward, aren't they? They're sort of crawling along the ground, really.
Yeah. When they hatch, they're just bare pink little guys. At the moment, they've got this lovely downy white fur. And you can see he's got a little Velcro tag on his thigh, which we'll just loosen off. And we come out here every week and we mark these chicks, and we keep an eye on every egg. Every chick that comes out of the egg gets recorded. And each chick that leaves the island will have a wing tag on it, like a big yellow cattle ear tag. And then members of the public can report the number, because they're all individually numbered. And we get an idea of how important this colony is and how far afield these little chicks go.
And this groaning behind us, that's the pelican. There's mother. Look, she's really opening her mouth up wide to us there at the moment. They really look like prehistoric birds to me.
And the babies look like baby dinosaurs, Mike. Mm. So food is at a premium with these animals. And so they compete fairly well with food. You'll see some of that with the chicks in particular. The chicks actually compete so much that sometimes siblings will kill each other.
Well, I've noticed a few dead babies on the ground.
Yeah, there's a huge mortality. About 30% of eggs that are laid actually get to hatch, and about 30% of chicks that hatch out of eggs actually fledge.
Well, Greg, we've just walked through the breeding colony, an amazing cacophony of sounds and smells. We've seen birth and death and eggs and hatchlings. It's just the most amazing experience right in this, with this background of industrial background behind us. Can you explain the research that you're doing for Zoos South Australia here?
Australian pelicans are one of the more robust pelicans around the world. There are 7 species of pelicans in the world. 2 of them are critically endangered. And Australian pelicans are thought to be okay, but now we're seeing worrying trends that there is actually a decline. We've been working on this particular breeding colony of pelicans on the edge of Adelaide since 1990, so 20 years now. And one of the things we discovered that was really interesting was that these pelicans, which are a pagan and biblical symbol of happy family life, parents giving of themselves for their youngsters, are actually competing aggressively with each other, and the nestlings actually engage in siblicide, where they will kill each other if food becomes short. So that's interesting of itself, but since that sort of initial discovery of academic interest, I suppose, we've realised that if we can look at these seabird colonies and look at the levels of aggression and siblicide and mortality in the chicks, and it's related to the food, then we can use these breeding colonies to monitor what's going on in the oceans nearby. So the level of aggression that you see in the chicks and the nests behind us really do reflect the fish stocks out there in Gulf St Vincent and in the Southern Ocean.
So this sort of information that you're gathering from the field, how does that fit into the overall goal of zoos?
Animals live in the wild, and traditionally zoos have dealt with animals in cages. And that's been important as a way of educating people, of connecting particularly city people to their environment in some way. But zoos are increasingly pushing to have an involvement with conservation, and so that takes them back into the wild. And zoo breeding programs should be, and mostly are, about breeding organisms for release into the wild. If there's not a wild component to a program, then it's not really a conservation program. Taking the zoos into the wild is a brave step in the zoo industry, but it's a really important one if a role in conservation is to be taken seriously.
Back in the city, Adelaide Zoo has recently become home to 2 giant pandas from China. Wang Wang and Funi arrived here with much fanfare and publicity. They're the only pandas in Australia, and during their 10-year stay, they'll not only delight visitors, the zoo also hopes they'll breed. So despite the commitment to Australian animals, Director Chris West argues there's still an important role for high-profile exotic species at the zoo.
When you look at pandas, and you could say the same for gorillas and elephants and tigers, what I call the sort of A-list celebrity species, what they very often do is act as a draw card. They're incredibly good box office. And sometimes that's as far as people get. They think, oh, this is all a publicity stunt and it's good diplomacy and it's all about making lots of money. No, it isn't. Pandas themselves are the ultimate ambassador species. They're universally recognised, they're incredibly appealing, and that means that people will listen and think about pandas, but the story is the same. It's one of shrinking habitat, of dwindling numbers, of breeding problems, and the fact that we can actually, in a remote country to where they live, make a difference. Make a difference by breeding them so there's an insurance policy, make a difference by making that connection. And we'll do it explicitly too, because the revenue that we're generating from the pandas, a significant proportion of that we'll put into native Australian species conservation. So we want to make it clear that whilst pandas are terrific in their own right, in some ways they're a means to an end.
You're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National and our series on the future role of zoos. I'm Lynn Malcolm and we're at Adelaide Zoo in South Australia, where they've brought in psychologist Carla Litchfield to improve the zoo's effectiveness at delivering conservation messages to the visitors.
We think it's really important that you do two things. One is you get visitors to connect with nature, but to do that you have to really have the best possible enclosures so that the animals are at their best and their welfare is taken care of. They have challenges for finding food, they're not bored, and they're at their best behaving as normally as possible so that people will see them, care about them, love them, and then want to help save them. And then the second point is that we want to get through to people that every person can make a difference with their behaviour. And so we try and think of ways that we can get people in the zoo setting to get the right messages, but then go home and change their behaviour so that it will become more sustainable to try and help the natural environments that are shrinking.
One of the ways in which the zoo has tried to engage visitors with the plight of wild animals and to inspire them to adopt greener lifestyles is by offering a close encounter experience with three hand-reared cheetahs at Monarto Zoo.
Good boy, Skeezer.
Here. Skeezer, here.
This is keeper Matt Brewer introducing me to the big cats.
Good boy, so you can hear him purring. Skeezer, sit. Good boy.
Oh, what a magnificent creature.
Good boy, Skakiza.
Right up close, just like a big... And here's the
Scary.
Other one.
Scary. Scary, here. Sit.
Right.
Good boy. Here you go. Lucky enough to get all three.
Wow, the three of them here.
Tots.
They're Totsy. Magnificent. All those spots. There's so
boy.
Many
Sit.
Spots. And you've just got
Good
that
boy.
Cream cheese on your fingers. They're licking
yep.
it off. Oh.
Good boys.
That is spectacular.
Good boy,
they
Totsy.
Like a pat too.
Yep, they love getting a pat, so we do use patting as a reward. So oh. Scary, just in the middle here, you can hear them all purring. They're nice and oh. content there.
Am I able to pat?
Yep, if you just want to get behind them and okay. you can give them a pat down along their back.
One reason that these close encounter experiences are so positive is that people are really overwhelmed emotionally by it. You can see them, they actually get tears in their eyes. You can just really connect emotionally, and it does have a very powerful influence on them. And when you've had an incredible experience like that, you keep referring it back to, you know, in your memories in everyday life, and actually can sustain you and want you to change the world by having those amazing experiences.
Skeezer.
Oh, their coats
yeah,
are just really lovely. I can feel the longer fur on top, just along the their neck there. And they're licking each other as well. They lick each other's faces.
Carla has studied the impact of the cheetahs in changing visitors' attitudes to conservation.
They actually paid attention to all the details about cheetah conservation and threats in the wild. So that was shown as a change in knowledge because we interviewed them before and after the experience. And yes, their attitudes, they were already pro-cheetahs, but, you know, they became a bit more passionate. And then they said that they would do more behaviours that would help save cheetahs.
and you're really able to pat them very,
yep, so they are
very affectionately, aren't you?
Boys.
They're very really, relaxed. They're all really sitting up close, the three of them all together.
What I was interested in and had a student looking at is to make sure that it was in no way compromising the cheetah's welfare. So we found that they could choose to be very close, which two of them did, and one was close, but not as close as the others. So it didn't compromise their welfare.
Good boy. Ascari, free. So I've just said free to Ascari then. I've started to sense that he's actually losing a bit of interest. So we always try to finish on a positive note when we do work with these cheetah and do train with them. So by saying free and having that gesture in front of his face is basically saying to him, good job, we're finishing the session now, and he's free to go off and do whatever he wants.
Yeah, he just wandered off quite calmly and he's finished.
We need to sense when they are losing interest. If they do lose interest and they might walk off without us telling them to, then they might be not as likely to respond to any other commands we do. So we always try to finish on that positive note as well.
Adelaide Zoo is starting to take a more direct approach in trying to influence people to live more sustainably. Its newly opened EnviroDome offers interactive ecological games, glimpses into various habitats around Australia, and suggests practical ways to lighten your environmental footprint. It's the brainchild of the zoo's Michael Shanahan.
There are four simple things we can all do to stop climate change and save money.
The EnviroDome is a really big and adventurous project for a zoo. As far as zoos go, it is part of our mandate to educate people and raise awareness about conservation. Generally, zoos do that in relation purely to animals and animal conservation, whereas the EnviroDome was really a first deliberate step into looking at bigger issues like climate change and reduce, reuse, recycle, green issues, I suppose. So the building itself was designed to be a green building and showcase all of the latest green technologies that we could afford to do within the building. So really the point of the EnviroDome was to try and bring home environmental education to our visitors in a fun and positive way.
Zoos South Australia is also recruiting visitors to specific environmental campaigns to help counter some of the threats to wild animals around the world. For example, the destruction of forests by agriculture and mining.
One of the threats to primates in Africa is the illegal mining of coltan, and that turns up in mobile phones. So one of the things we've got is the They're Calling On You campaign, where we're asking zoo visitors to take a prepaid envelope or satchel and to actually recycle up to four mobile phones and send it in. The postage is already paid, and then those phones will be recycled, and wherever possible, minerals will be taken out of it, such as coltan, and used again, which means the demand for coltan isn't increased, but also there'll be less for landfill. And so that's another way that people can do a very practical thing, and they're really jumping on board with this campaign because they can see the obvious link. They engage with the animals at the zoo, they see the threat to their habitats, and then they know, here's a simple thing I can do that actually helps.
We have to be activists. The urgency now with the rate of extinction is such that it's important to stand up and say, this is what we think. And more than that, to act as a sort of a beacon or a rallying point for members of the public. So, for example, with palm oil and orangs, we believe that it's important for there to be greater understanding of the consequences of people buying so many products that contain palm oil that isn't sustainably grown. So we are running and part of campaigns where we're saying to people, don't do this, because if you do, the consequence is that orangs and other species will go extinct. So absolutely, if zoos don't stand up to be counted, who will?
And according to Chris West, there needs to be a new sense of urgency for zoos. as we begin to see the impact of climate change.
I think it's focused a lot of attention on the fact that I used to think we had a number of horsemen of the apocalypse, as it were. So habitat destruction, overhunting, fishing and invasive species pollution, a number of major drivers that were pressing animals and plants into extinction. And there it was enough with all of that. And then you've got another huge horseman of the apocalypse that's dwarfing all of these other ones, and it's climate change. The estimates are that by mid-century, another 30% or so of species will have gone extinct because of climate change. It just reinforces the fact that we have to do the campaigning, the grassroots work, the inspiration, education, and we have to get out in the wild more.
Many applaud the fact that more zoos are taking their activities beyond their physical walls. But within zoos themselves, in their exhibits, commentator David Hancox argues that zoos should make greater efforts to reveal the rich complexities of nature to their visitors.
What I'd really like to see zoos become is, in some form, a 3D version of a really top-rate natural history television programme. A place where you take people on a journey and you get them to understand many strange and wonderful and compelling things about plants and animals and their habitats and their interactions, and not just continue this tired, worn-out format they have of, here's an exhibit for elephants, and you walk and you see that, and then you go and you walk and you look at some bears, and you go and you walk and you look at some zebras. That might have been sufficient for the Victorians, but we have a much more urgent and complicated and dramatic need for zoos to play today.
And next week on The Science Show on ABC Radio National, I'll be visiting a zoo in the United States which has created exhibits aimed at doing just this. This two-part series on the future role of zoos is a co-production between ABC Radio National and the BBC World Service. The producer is Andrew Luck Baker and sound engineer Louis Mitchell. And I'm Lynn Malcolm.
And do go to our Science Show website for pictures and much more on that zoo quest of Lynn's. Next week, the Bronx in New York.